amazing Kate Casey. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you guys have had a great week. This week, I got a chance to catch up with Juliet Angus from Ladies of London. Juliet is a London-based stylist and a digital influencer. I really wanted to talk to her about what it was like to be cast for the show and what it's like to go through the filming, because I think for those of us that kind of watch one of these shows, we think that is so glamorous that people just kind of pop into someone's lives and then they leave. When in fact, it's like 12 people show up to your house and they're asking you to film a scene in your kitchen with your kids. It must be pretty distracting. So I wanted to kind of find out from her what it's like, and also to hear how a show like that can change the trajectory of your career. She is a digital brand influencer, so she's working with all of these fashion houses and companies and beauty companies, and how being on a show like that really puts you on the map. And I know that you're going to like her just as much as I liked her. I asked Bud Siegel, a retired grandfather and champion Lego maker, to watch a Netflix documentary called After Porn Ends. I watched the first installment. He watched After Porn 3, because for some reason on Netflix, they've got After Porn Ends and then After Porn Ends 3. I don't know what happened to the second installment, but he's got some interesting perspective on it. And just the idea of him watching it just makes me laugh so much. I did make him watch at one time a wedding for the Duggars. So, I mean, the fact that he is willing to do the show makes me laugh so hard. This poor guy just wants to make Legos, and I made him watch a Duggar wedding on Counting Honor with the Duggars, and now a documentary about people who've left the porn industry. Jarrett Weisselman is a fellow reality TV lover. He lives and works in LA, and he is obsessed with this season of Real Housewives of Potomac. Now, these women, it's so funny how franchise to franchise, you've just got a totally different vibe. Well, these women go for each other's throats throughout the year, but especially during the season. And Jarrett believes that the reason why it's so good is that none of them are actually really friends. Like, they're just coworkers, which I believe they're all just coworkers. I don't know if anybody's really friends at this point. Once you agree to go on a show like this, I don't know how you could continue to be friends. But these women really were just like thrown in together. And that could be the reason that they have no scruples going after one another. So if you're on Twitter and on Instagram, there are all of these storylines that are coming out. I mean, they have to make that show all year long. I don't know how they can deal with bringing up at a reunion all the stuff that happens between the time that filming ends and when the reunion airs. It's bonkers. And then I asked Katie Hamilton, who appears on Marrying Millions on Lifetime TV, to talk to me about how she was cast for the show and this very unique relationship that she has. She's 37, a divorced mother of four girls, and she's in a relationship with her daughter's friend, and he is 23 and an aspiring hip hop star. So I tracked her down in Texas and had to ask her what happened and how she got on the show. You will probably remember her name because she also appeared for a short time on Real Housewives of Orange County and was supposed to be on the show. She was Heather Dubrow's neighbor and then pulled out at the last minute. And she kind of explains how that happened. So there's tons going on in this week's episode. Remember, there's also a new Patreon page for my show, and I'm posting extra stuff each month, bonus episodes. I have an episode which is behind the scenes of the show and how I book different guests. And I also just posted a new episode where I talk about my five favorite documentaries. And I'm going to have all new stuff coming up as well. So make sure you check out the Patreon page. And also, always remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes and to leave a 5-star review. I'm inching my way up to 3,000 reviews. So thank you so much for everyone who's left a review. And if you have not, it's so important. And I really greatly appreciate it. So here we go. You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. Juliet Angus is a London-based stylist, digital influencer, and you probably remember her from Ladies of London on Bravo. This morning, I've tracked her down in Chicago while on her summer vacation with her family. Juliet, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Do you feel when you come back like a sense of, like, I'm home? Are there parts of being in America that you miss?
Yeah, I mean, I love that everything, you know, is bigger and in a way better, because in London, it's so the opposite, you know, everything, they're so anti all of that, which I also love, you know, not the, it's so easy just to buy on Amazon. Although that's starting to happen a lot more, you know, if they say the butcher, you go to the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker for your things. And every neighborhood sort of has those little local shops, and everything's, you know, small, and they make it harder to get everything done. You know, I haven't made a scrapbook for my children since they were born, because, you know, scrapbooking out there, it's making a photo album, everything is a little bit more complicated. Here, I went to Michael's yesterday and I was like, what is this? Like, you have access to so much more. And in the UK, it's vintage back there, you know, things are done, you know, in these little smaller ways, and it makes life more difficult, but it also makes it a little bit, you know, sweeter and foreign. It's a foreign way to live for an American.
Your daughter was she born in Montreal?
She was born in Montreal and Truman was born in London.
And I know you've said that Truman has a beautiful British accent. Do they celebrate American holidays?
You know, 4th of July is always the hardest for me. I haven't celebrated a 4th of July in America since we moved there, because the kids are still in school. I mean, the kids just got off of school last week, because of the way the school system is broken down, they have these long holidays. You know, they get off for a month at Easter, a month at Christmas, and then there's half terms. So in between each term, there's a week break, where in the spring term, people will go to their homes in France, or in February, there's a half term, everybody goes skiing. And it's just, my husband has never seen more people vacation, you know, than people in the London schooling system, because there's an excuse to go away. And it's actually not normal, because it's constantly vacation planning over there.
Now, you were born to European parents, raised in the northern suburbs of Chicago, went to college in Los Angeles. Tell me a little bit about your life before we saw you on TV.
Yeah, my parents immigrated from Poland. I was born here. I grew up speaking Polish. I grew up in Northbrook. And the high school that I went to, Glenbrook North, was a huge, big high school. It's the high school that's in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, a very John Hughes neighborhood. It was very, very team sports. You know, our basketball team was top 8 in state. All our sports were big. And so when I was making my decision for college, I knew I wanted to go to a school that was like that. And again, not in the Midwest. I wanted to go see, I said, what's the furthest that I could go? And it was either going to be out east. It was between Boston University and USC. I wanted to do journalism. I wanted to be a newscaster, the next Katie Couric. You know, I looked at Indiana, but I said, I want to go. I want to see the other part of the U.S. live. So I went to USC and found a school that the collegiate sports, I mean, our football team's legendary, the tennis team's always national champion. So I loved that part of going to university and growing up with this kind of team pride and athletics. And I love sports so much. I wanted to actually be a sportscaster. But I realized I only knew everything about the Chicago sports and Michael Jordan and the 85 Bears, not about every sport and every team. So I, you know, wanted to thought maybe keep me a weathercaster. When El Nino was happening when I was in college, so I really got to get in on the weather. But yeah, so I ended up at USC and it was great 4 years. And now I hear it's impossible to get into. And I mean, it was tough back then, but hearing all sorts of ways people are trying to get into USC these days.
So you had an internship at the E! Network and then senior year, and then you went on to work at the Style Network.
So I interned I seized the opportunity to be in a big city and in the journalism program. And I interned every semester at a different network. I worked for Fox Sports. I worked for the local KTLA. I worked for ESPN. And my senior year, I remember going to the E! Network and they weren't getting back to me. So I went to the building and got into an elevator with a bunch of people. And I said, does anybody work at E! And know the person that hires interns? I'm really eager. And they put it on their desk. And I got the internship and I interned for E! News with, what was her name, Jules Asner, and some other big people at the time, and worked on news. And then I was one of the first people, you know, in college to get a job offer because that internship, they were starting the Style Network, which wasn't very long lived. I had already kind of opened up my fashion. My college roommate was a former model and loved, I've never seen anybody have Prada in the closet at my, you know, as a 18, 19 year old before. So I really started to get into fashion in LA and it was so different from my Chicago J. Crew fashion. And I started, that's when my kind of fashion started to open up and love for it.
I mean, I am always fascinated by the amount of people that you know. So when you mention your college roommate, she's like worked at Vogue. I mean, she's like big time. And then you see pictures of you with Lindsay Lohan. You've known Tinsley Mortimer for years. Does it fascinate the people that are around you, how many people you know?
You know, I guess people in London don't really know. They kind of wonder how easily it was for me to, I guess, penetrate the social circle. But I kind of was introduced to people in a social circle from all the people that I knew growing up, or grew up, I say, my formative kind of womanly years were in LA. And this was at a time I kind of related to Studio 54 years, where anybody who lived in that area who, you know, went out, they all knew. They're like, oh yeah, I knew Andy Warhol. I knew so-and-so. And I used to, like, Jagger used to have parties. So I would be at his house all the time. And it was kind of like groups. So that's kind of the way this like kind of LA group, it was all these 20-year-olds and, you know, we were going out to clubs and we were working different places. And I had two guy roommates. One of them ended up being in the Britney Spears movie. And the other one was, you know, Bruce Willis's best friend. It just kind of happened. One of my other roommates played Tom Hanks and was the small Tom Hanks and big David Moscow. Mm. And it was just like, you just kind of, these are people that were just ended up being your roommates. And, you know, you go out to the clubs and you stand next to Leo DiCaprio and then Justin Timberlake was in the booth to the left. And it was just kind of, everybody ended up kind of knowing each other in this, it was, I guess it was a party club rat kind of group, but it was also, you know, fun people that wanted to have fun in their 20s. And again, I lived in New York for a year, worked at NBC at Rockefeller Center. So I lived in New York. I met a bunch of people in New York through my former college girlfriend, Lauren, who was living there. So I met all these New York people. I worked on the same floor as SNL. Chris Kattan ended up being one of my best friends coming to my wedding. And it's just the way I've kind of opened up my, and it's not like, you know, I've lots of normal friends, but I did work in fields and tried so many different things that opened me up to a lot of different people. You know, I lived in New York, I lived in LA. And then I moved back to LA and started a fashion PR firm. And I don't know, I traveled a lot in my 20s also, you know, had different kinds of boyfriends, younger, older, you know, European and not, I was never afraid in my 20s to go, to try something new.
You moved to London. You're 8 months pregnant with Truman. You've got a toddler. You have mm-hmm. said you didn't really know anybody. And then 2 years later, you're cast for Ladies of London, which was really structured to be around women in social circles, like almost like a Sex in the City, but in London. How did they find you?
That's what it was. It was supposed to be. It was supposed to be more Sex in the City than your usual cat fighty housewives show. When I moved to London, I went on every blind date that anyone said, I have a friend who you should meet out there. I mean, I literally started dating women for friends because I didn't have very many friends. And all of my closest, bestest friends ended up being through someone that someone introduced me to that they had met through a friend one time at a dinner. So all these great, like, you know, my five closest friends became people that I was introduced to in some way from somebody else. And I also knew that I wanted to get back to work in London. When I was living in Montreal, I couldn't get a job because I don't speak French. I speak Spanish fluently and Polish. And in Montreal, you have to have French as a second language, super fluent in it. So I knew I would never work living in Montreal for those 4 years, but I knew I wasn't done working. I wanted to get back into work. So I started applying for high fashion jobs. I met with Jimmy Choo, Burberry, and then I ended up meeting with a PR firm that was handling Erdem and Christopher Kane and Oscar De La Renta and Ares with Sony. And it took me a year to get this change, but what they wanted was what I had learned how to do in LA in PR, which was basically having brands and how you work with stylists in the US and sending samples and also influencers. And at the time, no London PR firms were doing that. So I did a business plan and it took me a year to get this job, this huge proper business plan to have my own division of this PR firm. And as I was doing that, a casting director, at the same time I'm trying to get this one job in this fashion dream career, I mean, the dream fashion job, a TV producer is reaching out to me and I'm interviewing, being put on tape for a show about Americans living in London, kind of like a housewife show, to be pitched possibly for Bravo. So at the same time that I'm doing both of these things, I'm like, whichever one's going to stick, I'm going to do. Well, it happens that both of them, I'm really giving you insight. Both of them at the same time were like, yes. So I took the fashion job, not knowing if something, you know, may end up not happening with the TV show, with the cast, the budget, you never know. So I start this job and they're like, okay, well, yeah, and it's amazing. And 3 months later, the Bravo contract is like, you need to sign. So I told my job, I want to do this TV show. And they're like, you can't. You have to stay at the fashion job or quit and do your show. And I was like, well, no, I want both. I mean, these are both dream things of mine. And in my 30s, this is either one of these would have been the best. And now I have both options. So I ended up working really hard and just making myself indispensable at the job and telling Bravo I'm going to have to figure out a way to make the show work after hours and on weekends because I don't want to quit this job because what if we shoot it and it never makes it air and the air and I've just left what I've worked for a year and a half. So I ended up doing both with a 2-year-old and a four and a half year old at home. And I mean, it was the craziest year of my life, but it was the year that I actually felt the most organized and saw things most clearly was when I had no time at all to worry about anything else than my kids, making sure they're okay, and these two careers that were dreams of mine. And this energy that all of that had is I realized that the more busier I am, the less you waste time on all the ridiculous things and worries and you just kind of go. And when the show got picked up for a second season, I did have to leave my fashion job. And then the show got picked up for a third season. And I said, what is my career now? And that's when Instagram started, was about season three, and Instagram started, and bloggers started popping up everywhere. And I said, okay, well, why don't I try to get my fashion energy out there and what I'm passionate about through this new platform?
How hard was it to get acclimated to having all of these camera people follow you?
So for me, stage presence or being on camera, when there's a camera on, I've always loved that. So for me, there's no fear associated or any sort of awareness. Like I felt natural. It's when the manipulative situations start happening that it gets to be inorganic, you know, between women and all that drama that you just kind of, you don't even know what you're thinking anymore, what you're saying, because they want you to act a certain way. Or if you can't stand someone, they want you to sit down and tell them that you can't stand them. You're like, I wouldn't do these things in my normal life. You can just walk away. But when you're in this situation, it's like, it's hyper sensitized and really, you know, unorganically organic for a viewer and for them. But sometimes these moments of handling situations you wouldn't normally do in your life because you don't have to.
How did stress manifest for you?
Yeah, I guess stress from when my husband's trying to work, but they're like, we want your husband for a scene, you know, at 3 o'clock on Friday and he's at the office. And so you're trying to manage making, you know, the show great or what they want versus what realistically, you know, my husband's the one putting the roof over our head and the food on the table. So to sabotage what he's doing for my activity, it's one thing if I'm asking him for career advice when he's home from the office. Is one thing when I'm telling him I need you for my career. That's not really the career that's taking care of all of this. And that's where the pressures and the stress came out. You know, it was trying to manage high expectations of producers and the network to where my family felt comfortable.
There are a few people that you've remained friends with, and you can tell from your social media that you've stayed friends with them from the show. How hard is it to continue to cultivate friendships with the stress of filming a show about, which oftentimes highlights seemingly simple bickering between two women, but it's obviously heightened on a TV show, and then you're watching it back 6 months later. So how do you still cultivate those friendships under that stress?
You just know, who's really got your back and who's being genuine and honest, or who has an ulterior motive and starts acting in ways to make themselves like look better or for them to be a favorite. I mean, I could see right through that. I have a good instinct about that. So there's people I've steered away from for those reasons that I was like, wow, you're just the most ingenuine human being. And then there's things that for me, the way I act is so genuine. And I say things sometimes that somebody gets offended, but I don't mean it that way. It's just the way I am. Or if I'm too brass about something, I think people know whether it's coming from a good place and if you genuinely have a good heart.
Who do you still keep in touch with? I know that you keep in touch with the Stanbury sister and sister-in-law and Caroline Fleming. I feel like I just saw you were visiting her. Maybe is she leaving London? Is that what I saw?
She moved to Denmark.
Wow.
It's a good move for her to do all these things that she wants to do on TV and with her cooking and her she has a product line at one of the department stores in Denmark. There's so much more she can expand on in business, I think.
Yeah.
And in London, it's just, it's harder. And there's lots of British chefs and, she's so good at cooking. It's bananas. I mean, I've never seen anyone in the kitchen more comfortable and more amazing than her.
Caprice, do you ever see her? It feels like you guys were living on two different planets when the show was filmed. So I'm assuming years later, it's the same thing.
I see her and I go the other way. I see her in London. I mean, I recently kind of bumped into her in an event. So I said, hello, but, there's been zero contact in years.
Marissa now lives in primarily in Los Angeles, but she visits London time to time. Do you guys, kind of stay in touch despite living on different continents?
Yeah, we went through a kind of a rough patch and we're good now. So yeah, we see each other when we can, when she's in town or if I'm in town. I went to go visit their great restaurant, the Draycott, recently with Gregor. We had a couple's dinner. And I mean, Marissa was one of my very, very close friends, and that's the TV show. Definitely made us, frenemies from the situations we were put in. And also, I think the way she handled a lot of the situations I didn't expect, and I saw a different side, but I think it was manufactured from the situation and the circumstances. And some people act differently with a television show, but I think outside of it, we're fun.
Well, Noelle, how is she?
I've seen Noelle a couple of times recently. I've always loved Noelle. We were also very close friends. I think life hasn't turned out the way she had hoped. She's always wanted true love and finds relationships that are quite, I don't know how you say the right word.
Complicated and tumultuous.
Bad boys and difficult situations and not... not the guy next door. She never goes for that kind of sort of type. She has an adorable son. She's loving being a mom. I'm not sure, in the relationship department, if things have, happened the way she'd always hoped,
Caroline and Sophie, I think I just saw that you were together.
I see Caroline so much during the year. You would think we were next door neighbors, but she lives in Dubai, but she's constantly in New York. We used to go to LA together all the time. Our families adore each other. The kids all love each other. Her daughter and my daughter love each other, and her twin boys and Truman. I just had the boys over for two nights in London for sleepovers because we're always staying with them. So I said, they would rather stay at my house, the boys, than the Ritz. And I said, okay, well, that's hilarious. They had their little slippers and their ropes, and they said, no, we want to go stay at Truman's house. I had them over for two nights in London. It was really sweet.
Annabelle, any, kind of thoughts when you think back to being on the show?
I think the show was great for Annabelle. But there was so much that she didn't want to talk about. And I think it was hard to have to be open yet not in her, mind, be able to share so much of her real experiences. But I think the show was a great time for Annabelle. She was doing, I think, the best during the year that she was on the show. And it's so sad that, that self-sabotage that situation. But I love getting to know her, and I do miss her and think of her often. And I mean, we started off on the wrong foot, and then in the end ended up getting quite close. But then the last years was tough. I couldn't get a hold of her, didn't get a response to see her. And so sad. Pretty cool chick.
So now today you're a highly successful digital influencer. You've really been able to do something that very few people have done.
I mean, it's so nice to hear. Thank you. Because I'm just never pleased. It's this weird industry is nothing like anything before. I guess in an office job or in other careers, there was things that you could measure your success by. And measuring your success is, yes, and how many brands you get to work with, but also how many likes you get or how many views. And it's very strange and sometimes so unfulfilling, process. This is, again, I'm not of the median age of an Instagrammer and an influencer, I mean, the median age is, I'd say, probably 20, 28, and, you know, 30, and I'm a decade above that. And it's not a career that I went to school for. It's not something that you could study up on, although now there's college courses all over for it. This was this career that I started doing. I've had to figure out what it is as it was happening and constantly, you know, be wondering and questioning if it's good enough, if people are going to like it, because you don't, there's no gauge except these like likes and numbers. And I guess you're following to keep my following or to keep growing. I mean, right now I'm kind of stagnant. You know, how do you get exposed? When I was on the TV show, it was great because you had so many more eyes. So every season it'd be thousands and thousands of new followers. And that's how I grew. Now, you know, growing, it's kind of stagnant. So, I'm holding on to the people that have gone on the journey with me from when I started, I guess, which was 5 years ago now. So 5 years ago. And I don't know, I want to show people from these stories is where most people come to my, follow me for. It's the numbers are, you know, I could have up to 50,000 views on a story, especially when I'm traveling to a fabulous location where people are tuning in. But that's so easy for me to do because I have been on TV and I do love my life and showcasing, you know, my daily kind of things. So it's so great that that has kind of come into fruition in the last 2 years. Because without that, with just Instagram, I felt I wasn't expressing. I felt like people couldn't get the gist of me. Whereas with stories, I'm so happy that I get to communicate in that way.
It's kind of like your own channel. So do you think that could you see yourself being involved with a project on TV again?
Yeah, there's been rumblings of Ladies of London coming back. So making it what it probably should have been originally. I think the first season was the best that it was. And making London the city, one of the characters. I think we lost a lot of amazing things to do in London and cast members. There's so many interesting women in London from all over the world. So it doesn't have to be British or American. It's so international. So getting more international women.
Well, tell everybody how they can start to follow you if they're not already following you and kind of get a window into your life living in London.
Well, you'll get to know a lot about me right away if you follow me on Instagram at Juliet, especially through my stories. I'm constantly posting them, although it may be a lot of Target and Home Depot stuff right now, which you'll be a little bit more familiar. But when I'm back in London and traveling the world, it may be more fun to watch. Right now, it may be a baseball game and downtown Chicago, a little festival, Lollapalooza is coming up, which I do every year. I just love it. I love being home. But that's kind of the best way to follow along.
Well, thank you so much.
This is a therapy session / autobiographical. I mean, I don't know if anyone's been told all the things I told you today. It's kind of, I just wrote my book.
Listen, I know you're looking for a new deodorant, and guess what? I found you one. Native is formulated without aluminum, parabens, and talc. It's filled with ingredients found in nature, such as coconut oil, shea butter, tapioca starch, and made in the USA with ingredients thoughtfully sourced from around the world. And there's no animal testing. Native can hang out with your workout, your busy day-to-day life, or your 16-hour workday. People love Native. They have over 7,000 five-star reviews. You can check out information about them on the Today Show, Women's Health, Elle, Good Morning America, Pop Sugar, Nylon, Hello Giggles, and more. Classic deodorant scents include coconut and vanilla, which is the most popular scent, lavender and rose, my favorite, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint. There's no risk to try, and they offer free returns and exchanges in the U.S. So for 20% off your very first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code REALITY during checkout. So again, that's 20% off your first purchase. Visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code REALITY during checkout. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house, but I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you gotta get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're gonna love it. Bud Siegel is a father, a grandfather. He's retired. He is a master Lego builder. Bud, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
For those that have never heard of this documentary, it examines the lives and careers of some of the biggest names in the history of the adult entertainment industry and what happens to them after they leave the business and try to live the normal lives that millions of other Americans enjoy. Had you ever heard of this documentary before?
Not until about 2 days ago or 3 days ago when my daughter called.
Now, it was interesting. She said, I think that my dad would be a great source. She claims that there was a week in her life where all the cable channels were working and that you could watch Skinamax or porn on the television. And she claims that your brother was very interested in the programming. Do you have a recollection of those days?
Yes. To go back a little bit, my son had the ability to stick a nail in the cable box and get the Playboy channel. So this goes back, let's see, she's now 49, so she probably was about 13, and he was probably 11.
Oh my gosh.
So he got the Playboy channel. So they figured they needed some adult supervision, and I was there to help them.
So you let them watch it?
Not really, but we got involved. It was only for a week, and then, you know, I took the nail away.
Unbelievable. Well, it's funny because she still has memories of one specific program about a princess theme. So
I think it was Cinderella.
It was Cinderella and something about a magic vagina. I do remember that. Yes. So it is interesting that all these years later, I forced you to watch this program because it really shows the dark side of the porn business. I mean, I never really think that much about porn, and I certainly never really think about what happens to the people once they leave the business. Would you say that overall this is a Debbie Downer kind of film?
No, because I watched episode three. I think it was whatever the one you told me to watch. And frankly, the ones who mentally could handle it, I thought did very well through it because they didn't really have any other professions to go into. And they looked at it as a business. And the ones they had on, one gal had an addiction issue, which she apparently got over the second time. Found religion, and she was doing whatever she wanted to do. The other ones kind of figured out that once they got through doing the movies, they had to find something else to do if they didn't want to continue doing the movies. So they got into dancing and this and that and whatever. And they seemed to have got it sorted out. So, you know, I didn't find it as a downer. That's what I'm saying. I had an issue watching it because I thought it was going to be, different than what it turned out to be. It was like a serious documentary on how these people muddled their way through a career, frankly.
I had the opposite perspective. There was a woman that they interviewed. She had been working in the industry for quite a bit, Nina Hartley. And she said, the people that are successful or actually get into porn are people that have no other life skills. Like, they can't have a 9-to-5 job. They have nothing else going for them. So that was a little bit of a downer. And then they interviewed this woman named Chrissy Moran. She's the one that sort of found the Lord. And she seemed to be falling apart. She couldn't even string a sentence together, seemed to be staring off into space. And it seemed like she was worried that she would never find true and lasting love. Now, this was filmed, 5 years ago? So I need to do some research to see if she's okay. But I got a bad sense that she would maybe drive a car off a cliff. What was the most memorable person that you saw featured in After Porn 3?
Tara Patrick.
Oh, because
she really had her head on her shoulders. I mean, she knew exactly what she was doing. She knew where she wanted to go with it. She was able to quit the movies and go into dancing and whatever. She met some guy. She went to ended up in Italy. Met some guy, an Italian guy in Italy. She thinks she's terrific, and she's living happily ever after. And they had another one, Christy Cannon, I think her name was, who was back from the 80s, who had been working for Playboy Cirrus on the radio for 10 years, and she switched to something else for 3 or 4 years on the radio, and she loves it. So, frankly, none of them seem to be suffering from it. Another one wanted to do it for 5 years, make $1 million, quit. So she did exactly that, got married, has, I think, 2 children, and is living on the beach.
So I will say
I was impressed. I mean, it's not an industry I would advocate somebody going into, but most of these people came from places you don't want to come from, and they've ended up making something of themselves.
In After Porn 1, there's a gentleman that's interviewed. His name's Randy West, I believe. He was a baseball player, and then he got injured, and then he became this very famous male lead in porn. And he was in love with Tara Patrick. He tried to have a relationship with her outside of the business, and he said it was very difficult for him to date because the women that you're kind of meeting in that world are just the women you work with. So it's awkward because you have this, you know, pretty graphic sex scene that you have to perform, and then you leave the scene, and it's awkward to say, well, do you want to go out and like have a drink, or, you know, go watch a movie? It's like you're moving backwards. And he said that Tara Patrick was the true love of his life. Isn't that so sad?
No. I mean, it happens. I mean, people, you know, they have crushes on, you know, other people, and it doesn't work out. The one I watched had 2 couples who had gotten married. One were a very attractive couple, and the other one, less so attractive. They seem to be perfectly content with each other, and they both met each other. Both couples met each other in the industry. So, except for some obnoxious guy who kept coming on saying, you know, you shouldn't speak negatively about the porn industry, all the other ones kind of understood it was a business, and they treated it as such. And like any business, I mean, people work for regular companies, get all messed up within the organization, and some of these people got messed up, and some of them did very well by it. And considering where they came from, I mean, one had a degree in philosophy. I forgot which one. I think that was a guy who was into whipping and stuff like that. So, you know, who knows? I was kind of, you know, I was looking forward to seeing this thing only because I thought it was going to be ridiculous, like some of the other things I've seen. And it wasn't ridiculous. It was human pathos. And the ones that I watched were fairly were intelligent, could communicate, and you could relate to them. So I became empathetic to the whole thing. I mean, as I said before, it's not an industry I would advocate going into because it has a lot of pitfalls to it. If you're coming from nowhere and you're going nowhere, it's better than nothing. The documentarians took it very seriously.
Mm-hmm. They did. I agree.
And the folks participating in it, for the majority, took it very seriously also.
Would you recommend this documentary to anyone looking to learn more about the industry, or just to somebody who just loves documentaries?
I'll put it this way. I think your note said watch 30 minutes of it, and I watched the whole thing. And that's because I became interested in the people who were in the documentary, not because of the subject matter. So if I was asked to watch it voluntarily, you know, for the sake of nothing better to do, I wouldn't watch it. It certainly didn't do any harm watching it. And it was, as I said, it was interesting.
In other news, what Lego are you working on right now?
I am starting the Kawamoto Castle in Japan.
Do you do your own design, or are you following?
No. What I do is I find people who do the designs. So I found a guy. Like, I finished the Budapest Opera House, which was 55,000 pieces.
Holy.
And now he's done this castle, which is 46,000 pieces. So I buy the design from him, and along with the design comes what pieces I need, et cetera, et cetera. And I buy the pieces from Lego or from various, and Lego doesn't have them all, honestly. So I buy them from a website called BrickLink. And for this particular thing, I bought them from, I think it was 48 different vendors around the world.
Holy crap.
And it takes me about 3 months to get all the pieces in, sorted, counted, et cetera. And I just finished getting all these sorted. And I'm missing some, so I'm ordering more stuff. And I should be ready to start building in about 10 days.
And when you're building, are you listening to anything? Do you listen to music? Do you need total silence?
No, I usually watch TV.
And what are you watching?
Whatever's on, usually sports or something like that.
Okay. So
it's something that I can look up and down that I don't have to really pay attention to.
So would you watch like a Real Housewives show in the background or Jersey Shore?
I wouldn't watch either one of those if I was on my deathbed. Next. Sorry.
Would you say after porn ends is great Lego background noise?
No, because I was actually watching it. So I wouldn't be able to do both of them. I watched it on my computer, actually.
Oh, that's
I didn't want to watch the, I didn't my wife says, "Why don't you, you know?"
Oh, I know.
I don't know how many TVs we have in this house. She says, "You know, watching on one of the TVs." I said, "I'm busy making notes."
Also, it's kind of embarrassing. I mean, I had to watch it on my computer too because my kids are walking around. And God forbid they walk past. I'm like, "Mom, what are you watching?" So I totally get it.
I don't even know why it was an MA. I mean, it was hardly any nudity on mine. I mean, it was, you know, it was a documentary. It was like opening National Geographic.
I just think you're the best. I thank you so much for watching this. And I am so grateful to you. And I'm hoping that you and your wife have a great summer.
Thank you. And it certainly was much more interesting than the wedding you made me watch.
I made you watch the Duggars. I know that Duggar, was pretty depressing. And you know, they've had about 17 children since I made you watch that.
Well, I frankly, I've been in recovery ever since then. We've canceled our subscription to Us and People magazine and anything with their pictures on it.
Can you believe the people write about them? I'm like, that is a family that's depressing. Why would you want to walk past a picture of them on the cover of People magazine? Like, that is, I mean, you're already at a grocery store buying like toilet paper and then you got to look at that. I agree. What a depressing story.
Now you know why Amazon has become so successful. You don't have to go to the grocery store.
Jarrett Weisselman is a fellow reality TV lover. He lives and works in LA. We go way back. Jarrett, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So I am dying to talk to you about this season of Real Housewives of Potomac. That show kind of began as a snooze for me, and it's getting pretty juicy. What do you think?
I completely agree. You know, it feels a little bit like the way Dallas, because, you know, Dallas was originally designed as not a Housewives franchise, and I believe Potomac wasn't either. And so you have these early season sort of machinations of other shows where they're trying to be, you know, grander than Housewives. And so the first two seasons of those shows didn't really work. And then once the women returned in season two, knowing it was a Housewives show, like all bets were off. And Potomac has been a series for me that over the course of these four seasons, every single season has gotten better and better and better until current airing fourth season, which is truly, I think, one of the best seasons of Housewives in a long time.
So who is standing out for you right now as kind of like leading the show in terms of watchability? Who's standing out for you?
Well, listen, I mean, Giselle is always going to be the word on the street, and she's always fantastic. But what's been crazy is while Giselle and Karen really drove, I thought, you know, the first 2 years of the show, Ashley sort of bringing in. But I will say, adding Candace last year changed the energy of the entire show. She was like a breath of fresh air who came in. And this season, for me, Candace is the star of this show. I mean, that's not necessarily a good thing, given the fact that Candace threatened somebody, you know, threatened Ashley with a knife a couple of weeks ago, and can't stop crying because her mom hit her in the face with a purse. It's just, but for me, all the action this season that is interesting revolves around Candace. And so to me, that makes her the centerpiece of season four.
Does it bother you that her name is spelled Candy Ass?
I hate it so much. I refuse to actually spell it that way whenever I'm texting my friends about like the episodes. I just, my phone doesn't acknowledge it as a spell check. And honestly, neither do I. So I can't. It's annoying. It's annoying. But knowing her mother, I completely understand why that's how her name is spelled.
Oh, the mom. Is she one of the worst people on TV?
Well, here's what I don't understand about Potomac. First of all, Ashley's mom 2 seasons ago was really one of the darkest things I feel like I've seen on any Housewives franchise. And I watched season one of Beverly Hills, right? I watched Kim crying in the back of that limo after Kyle stole her house. But watching Ashley and Michael like force their mother out of their lives financially and emotionally was so upsetting to watch. So like, I don't know why these moms keep coming on these shows. I don't know why Candace's mom is on the show. I don't know why Ashley's mom continues to be on the show. I would love a moratorium of all mothers who are not Tinsley's mom and D on Dallas.
Do we believe Candy Ass's mom is a real therapist?
Gosh. I mean, I believe she fancies herself a therapist. It's just, you know, it's always so funny to me. And this isn't even about the moms, but I never put any faith or any stock in any therapist who ever appears on any Housewives franchise. Like when Bethany was going to that therapy, like whenever you're in a therapy session on a Bravo show, I'm like, this person is not a real therapist. Real therapists would not do this. Real therapists have like better things to do with their time. So I'm sure she is a therapist. In the same way, the 95 therapists who treated Bethany over the last 5 seasons are therapists. So like, not really, but probably.
Think about Katie coming back to the show, because stuff online within her life seems pretty dark. However, when I'm watching her, I don't mind her as much. Is there something wrong with me?
No, there's nothing wrong with you. I don't mind Katie this season. Listen, I think the thing is, there's a very specific kind of person who is more successful as a friend of the Housewives than an actual Housewife themselves. I think Camille Grammer is a great example of that, although this season has torpedoed her entire brand. But I think Katie's a really good example of a friend of a Housewife who on her own isn't interesting, but as long as she's in a scene with someone else acting as a sounding board or a catalyst for action, I'm fine with it. I will say this, and I'm not knocking anybody, but like there's some weird wig stuff happening on Katie all the time in every scene of every episode of this season. I don't understand it. I don't judge it. I would like to know more, and I would like to know why, because you were a model, as you say, constantly, and you bought that weird farm that felt like death lived there when you were very, very young with $1 million cash. So like, you know about style, you know what looks good. So there's something weird. And when they were on that trip, and the camera kept cutting to her and she was super late, like spending like an hour putting like necklaces on her head and like around her. It felt like a version of Grey Gardens that I didn't expect, but I'm also very ready for.
Okay. What do you think about what is going on with Ashley and her husband?
I think this groping of the cameraman thing is very bizarre and very crazy. It was also, I don't know if you caught it, but they said that Michael groped the cameraman at Monique's rainbow baby party, which basically means while Ashley was crying about her miscarriage, Michael was allegedly groping a cameraman. And it just, to me, feels like a marriage of convenience for the show, they basically end up splitting up between every single season and coming back together when the cameras are there. So to me, Michael and Ashley have now had a baby for the cameras. They have now had a marriage for the cameras. And I'm very much looking forward to the divorce that they have for the cameras.
By the way, they posted the picture, the first one, after the baby was born. And she is in the hospital bed, looks exhausted, of course. And it looks like Michael is breastfeeding the baby. It's really strange.
I mean, listen, I feel like if Michael could, he would. So I'm sure he tried just to see what was possible.
What are you looking forward to seeing this season?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I really would like to see Karen getting in there a little bit more. I feel like Karen, who was such a driving force for storyline over the first three seasons, I think, you know, the death of her parents has kind of rocked her a little bit, and she took a while to get back in it. You know, you saw Karen getting down and dirty with Ashley at Katie's party last week, which I appreciated that return to form. I also loved that yellow crop jacket she was wearing. I thought it was super cute and very April O'Neil Ninja Turtles, and I want more of that. So I would love to see Karen coming back to her senses a little bit more. I have to say, for me, the biggest actual surprise of the season is how much I've enjoyed Monique. She's a housewife who never really did much for me in her first 2 years. I mean, yes, she did threaten to choke someone with an umbrella, which is great. But this season, I find her to be really charming and funny and astute and witty. And I want more of that. You know, for me, Monique is the person who is the most on it right now about calling the women on their stuff. You know, when she was saying that, you know, when she had that conversation with Candace in last week's episode that led to their fight, I was fully on Monique's side. You know, Monique was saying, I'm not the kind of friend who will just yes you to death. I will tell you when you need to be checked. And the truth is, that's a real friendship. And, you know, Candace's response was, well, now I'm fighting with Monique, and I'm fighting with my husband, and I'm fighting with my mom. It's like, at some point you have to say, whoa, maybe I'm the problem, mm-hmm. not these three people who are saying to me the exact same thing. You know, you have to have a little self-awareness. You need to have a little bit of reflection. Although, listen, self-awareness is not a character trait I want in a housewife. I think it would do Candace a lot, a world of good, because I actually find her to be really watchable and enjoyable. And if she could find the space to be slightly more self-aware and still a story driver and still kind of a jerk, like, that's the best case scenario.
I think the trick is to keep Monique pregnant, because that's when she is the most centered.
I know, but like, and listen, I love all children equally, but like, I am getting to the point where I feel like Monique has too many children. I get very stressed out once you need sort of like 4 to 5 carriages or thing, you know, I don't know. Like, once you sort of get above 5, I start to feel a little agitated, just myself. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just, I get very stressed out thinking about taking care of that many children. And there's a lot of children in the Samuels household.
I also think people just don't really want to watch little kids on shows. I think they like to see adults that make very poor decisions, but they're not interested in small children.
I agree. I mean, for me, like, the perfect age of children to have actually on the Housewives show is like the Kyle Richards age children.
Agreed.
I think, you know, obviously Portia was like a baby in season one, but she had Alexia, she had the older daughter. So like, we were kind of dealing with an older child, which I enjoy. You know, Avery Singer, I think, is another example of like the right age for me, because like, I want them to be people, and I don't really want anyone's storyline to be consumed by like, what, I don't have childcare, I can't come to your gala tonight. You know, like, I don't want that. I need to be available at the drop of a hat to put on a dress and go throw a drink in someone's face.
Mostly too, because a lot of the people that watch this show have small children and they want to escape their life. So if they've been at the park all day, they don't want to go home and watch a show about women wearing cocktail dresses in a park.
Exactly. If I've spent all day putting together a baby crib, the last thing I want to do when I turn on Housewives is watch two idiots try to put together a baby's crib.
So where can people track you down? Because I have to say, you are most enjoyable on Twitter. You always have great insight into TV shows and are so great with your quips. So where can they track you down?
Yeah. So yeah, Twitter, I am at Jarrett Says, and I am welcoming all conversations about Housewives at all times. If I'm at work, I will drop everything to have the most minute conversation about the most specific detail about these shows because it's truly, it's the obsession of my life.
Well, you're in good company. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KateCasey for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KateCasey to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/KateCasey. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. Marrying Millions is a new show on Lifetime. So essentially, you take a wealthy person, throw in some romance, someone from the opposite end of the income scale, and you kind of just watch to see what you're going to get. I'm so happy to tell you I've tracked down Katie Hamilton, who's on the show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So I am captivated by the show. I can't get enough. And first, I need you to take me a little bit back. So tell me where you're from originally.
Originally, I'm from Washington, D.C. But then in high school, I moved, my family moved to North Carolina. And that's actually where I met my ex-husband. We were in high school together. And since then, I've lived all over the country. And we've landed just outside of Dallas, Texas.
So you met your husband because your father was a motivational speaker. Tell me a little bit about how you met your ex-husband.
So after high school, I was selling real estate and Josh was not in baseball at the time. And my dad was actually a home builder and a land developer, but he did do a lot of motivational speaking around the country. And Josh came to my parents' house. Like he had met my father, at an event somewhere and they kind of kept in touch. And he went over and asked my dad if he had a job for him. And for the first time ever, I was actually selling new construction in one of the neighborhoods my dad was developing. And my dad put Josh at that neighborhood. So he was always coming into the sales office, like getting water and, you know, cooling off because it was hot outside. But really, he was just in there to flirt with me. And we hit it off and we were married 4 months later.
And so you had a daughter from a previous relationship. You got married. You had three children. And then I feel like I first saw you on Real Housewives of Orange County. I remember you being at like a rodeo party or some sort of party. So tell me a little bit about how you almost became a Real Housewife.
So the party to which you were referring was actually Heather DeBru's groundbreaking. So she was going to be my neighbor. Or she was my neighbor. And that's where I was first introduced to, I guess, the people of Real Housewives, some of the other, people. I got a call about 9 months later. It was in August and they were, contacting me about the show. So fast forward about 4 or 5 months, my ex-husband really wanted me to do the show. He thought I'd have a lot of fun. He had seen me do, like, he and our family, we did some reality stuff, TV stuff, I guess, before. And he really was very encouraging for me to do it, basically forced me into it. But we ended up filming for about 4 months, and 3 or 4 months, it was a
a lot of filming, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And then my divorce happened. He kind of lost his mind a little bit. And I just felt like I needed to make sure I could do everything in my power to make my marriage work and make sure there were no distractions. So I ended up resigning, and they were very gracious to me, very supportive, very, I had a very, very good experience. But really our divorce is what I feel like kept me from being able to fully pursue that and, you know, finish out the season. So I'm on a few episodes, but most of the footage, you know, didn't ever make the final copy. And it was a very, very tough time, but, you know, I do feel like I've made the right decision, because looking back, I know I gave my marriage everything, even throughout the whole divorce. So I don't have any regrets.
So how come they have not scooped you up for Real Housewives of Dallas?
You know, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I will say, I know it's a different studio.
How did the team from Marrying Millions find you?
They found me on Instagram, and I didn't really know details. I didn't know a lot of details about the show. I kind of thought it was going to be more along the lines of people in different seasons of life. Deep into the first week of filming that I started gathering, that it wasn't exactly what I had anticipated. But, you know, I mean, it's definitely been an interesting adventure.
So did you think the show was more about like a housewife-ish?
Maybe a little bit, but I just thought it was going to be more about like challenges that you face because you're in a different phase of your life, being a significant other, rather than as money-driven as it is.
Were you aware during filming of the other people that are highlighted on the show? And do you know any of them as well?
We don't know any of them. I asked probably 5,000 times to my producers who exactly was going to be on the show.
Yeah.
What was going to be the show's name? You know, just I wanted to know every single detail, and I really blurred them out with that, I think. So as soon as they were finally able to tell me a little bit about the other couples, I was very fascinated and, you know, interested to know that there was another couple in Dallas. And I guess I kind of was under a rock a little bit because I'm busy with my kids and everything, but I had never heard of Bill. I had never heard of him.
Your daughter, who's beautiful, is on the show with you in the first episode. She's explains to us that she was friends with Colton and he came to the house and that's how you guys met.
We all actually met at the same time, essentially. Like Julia and Colton had seen each other at a birthday party a couple days before he and I met, but they weren't friends yet. He and I, with a big group of people, went to a restaurant in Dallas, and he and I started talking based on the fact that he wasn't drinking alcohol. I was interested in that, kind of intrigued by it. So I asked him about it. And then he and I started talking and we definitely formed a bond, I guess you could say, right out of the gate. He and Julia definitely formed a great friendship, but it was really in the weeks that followed. She just doesn't really take me seriously when I try to tell her over the phone. So when she got back in town, she was very surprised by the news, but I think it had a lot more to do with the fact that this was the first time I dated since my divorce, more so than it did I was dating, quote, her friend. But she definitely used that a little bit, I think, to try to get me to change my mind about dating just in general. But if you watched last night's episode, you can kind of see like her demeanor start to change, which I appreciate very much that she's concerned about my happiness. But me being a mom, I'm always going to put my kids first and make sure they're okay before I can think about what I might want in life.
So I'm watching it as an outsider. And my first concern was, is Katie dating him because A, it's a safe. It's like easy to go to start to walk back into the dating pool with someone that perhaps does not look like somebody that I'm going to marry right away on paper, Or should I be worried that Katie is choosing him because she couldn't fix her husband, but she can fix somebody that's younger?
So those are actually both things that I have not yet heard. So kudos to you for like just observing that and picking up on either one of those scenarios. I would say option A is far more reflective of probably why I felt like it was maybe okay to, you know, stick my baby toe in the dating pool. It was probably unconsciously a safe choice for me to start dating him, because maybe on paper it didn't look like, okay, this is going to be forever. Yeah. Or there's a chance that it could be forever. I think probably for both he and myself together, we both probably figured the other one is a safe bet if we're not looking for something long term. And you know, I've heard him say in the past, like in the beginning, he thought, okay, well, surely there's a cap on, you know, on this relationship, and it's going to have a ceiling and it's not going to go beyond that. And, you know, I think we pretty quickly found out that may not be the case.
So is it weird to see your life play back on TV?
Not really. I know that like, it sounds like it would be weird, but it's not weird. I mean, I'm probably a little bit too critical of myself.
Will we see the other girls on the show, your younger three?
I don't think so, which is really disappointing, because they are so awesome and such a blast. I mean, they're just the coolest kids. I know every parent thinks that about their kids, but, you know, I'm no exception. And I really, really wanted them to be able to be on it, but it's an area that their dad and I didn't see eye to eye on. And I really didn't. I mean, I would never want to expose them to something that could potentially, you know, not be in their best interest. But me being able to show a complete picture of my life and me as a mother, because being a mom is such a huge part of my life, and it's one of the most important things I'm ever going to do in life, to not be able to show that fully, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but it is what it is.
So you can't obviously tell us the ending, but can you tell us
what
we can look forward to this season?
There's a lot of drama, actually. And I will tell you, like, I was very surprised by some people that are close to me, and how they've responded to me dating Colton. It's far more dramatic than I would have ever anticipated. And honestly, like I'm still navigating through a lot of that.
How can people follow you and kind of follow your journey while the show is on and afterwards?
They can find me on Instagram and Twitter at KatieHamilton32.
The amazing Kate Casey. I want to thank my great guest this week, Juliet Angus from Ladies of London, the irreplaceable Bud Siegel, Jarrett Weisselman, and Katie Hamilton. Remember, you should go to the Facebook search button and put in Reality Life with Kate Casey and jump in the Facebook group. We are talking about reality shows all week long, and you can talk about this episode as well. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet during shows and about shows all week long. And my Instagram is at Kate Casey, C-A. You can find all the guests that are upcoming each week and a little window into my life. As always, I am wishing you guys a great week, and I'm hoping that you get a chance this week to watch some great TV.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.